As he passed the bookstall in the lobby of the Hilton, a rack of magazines caught his attention, and he stopped at the shelf of women's magazines. There would be announcements of the Paris Haute Couture showing soon, and he thumbed through the pages of Vogue, looking for mention of Yves Saint Laurent's show. Instead, he was shocked by the image of a woman's face that leapt out of the page at him. The elegant cheekbone structure framing the huge, slanted Slavic eyes, the shimmering fall of dark hair, the feline grace of movement frozen by the camera flash. In the photograph, she was in a group of four people. The other woman was the estranged wife of a pop singer, the sulky expression, slightly skew eyes and bee-stung lips, a landmark on the Parisian social scene. Her partner was a freckled, boyish-faced American actor in a laid-back velvet suit with gold chains around his throat, more famous for his sexual exploits than his film roles. They were not the type of persons with whom Magda Altman habitually associated. But the man beside her, on whose arm she leaned slightly, was much more her style. He was 40-ish, dark and handsome in a fleshy, heavily built way, with dense wavy hair, and he exuded the special aura of power and confidence that befitted the head of the biggest American automobile manufacturing complex. The caption below the photograph had them attending the opening of an exclusive new Parisian discotheque. Again, this was not Magda Altman's habitual territory, but she was smiling brilliantly at the tall, handsome German, so obviously enjoying herself that Peter felt a stinging shaft of emotion thrust up under his ribs. Hatred or jealousy, he was not certain, and he slapped the magazine closed and returned it to its rack. In the impersonal, antiseptically furnished suite, he stripped and showered, and then, standing naked in the small lounge of the suite, he poured himself a whiskey. It was his third that evening. Since the kidnapping, he had been drinking more than ever before in his life, he realized. It could exert an insidious hold when a man was lonely and in grave doubt. He would have to begin watching it. He took a sip of the smoky amber liquid and turned to look at himself in the mirror across the room. Since he'd been back in Brussels, he had worked out each day in the gymnasium at the NATO Officers Club, where he still had membership, and his body was lean and hard, with a belly like a greyhound's. Only the face was ravaged by strain and worry, and it seemed by some deep, unutterable regret. He turned back towards the bedroom of the suite, and the telephone rang. "Stride," he said into the mouthpiece, standing still naked with a glass in his right hand. "Please hold on, General Stride. We have an international call for you." The delay seemed interminable, with heavy buzzing and clicking on the line, and the distant voices of other operators speaking bad French, or even worse English. Then suddenly her voice, but faint and so far away that it sounded like a whisper in a vast and empty hall. "Peter, are you there? Magda?" He felt the shock of it, and his voice echoed back at him from the receiver. There was the click before she spoke again, the switch of carrier wave that told him they were on a radio telephone link. "I have to see you, Peter. I cannot go on like this. Will you come to me, please, Peter?" "Where are you?" "Les Neuf Poissons." Her voice was so faint, so distorted, that he asked her to repeat it. "Les Neuf Poissons." "The Nine Fishes," she repeated. "Will you come, Peter?" "Are you crying?" he demanded. And the silence echoed and clicked and hummed, so he thought they had lost contact. And he felt a flare of alarm, so his voice was harsh, as he asked again, "Are you crying?" "Yes." It was only a breath. He might have imagined it. "Why?" "Because I am sad and frightened, Peter. Because I am alone, Peter. Will you come? Please, will you come?" "Yes," he said. "How do I get there?" "Ring Gaston at La Pia Benite. He will arrange it. But come quickly, Peter, as quickly as you can." "Yes, as soon as I can." "But where is it?" He waited for her reply, but now the distances of the ether echoed with the sound of utter finality. "Magda? Magda?" He found himself shouting desperately, but the silence taunted him, and reluctantly he pressed a finger down on the cradle of the telephone. Les neuf poissons, he repeated softly, and lifted the finger. Operator, he said, please get me a call to France, Rambouillet 478747. And while he waited, he was thinking swiftly. This was what he had been subconsciously waiting for, he realized. There was a feeling of inevitability to it. The wheel could only turn, it could not roll sideways. This was what had to happen. Caliph had no alternative. This was the summons to execution. He was only surprised that it had not come sooner. He would see why Caliph would have avoided the attempt in the cities of Europe or England. One such attempt, well planned and executed with great force, had failed that night on the road to Rambouillet. It would have been a warning to Caliph not to underestimate the victim's ability to retaliate. For the rest, the problems would have been almost the same as those that Peter had faced when planning the strike against Caliph herself. The when and the where and the how. And Caliph had the edge there. She could summon him to the selected place. But how incredibly skillfully it had been done. As he waited for the call to Rambouillet, Peter marvelled at the woman afresh. There seemed no bottom to her well of talent and accomplishments. Despite himself, knowing full well that he was listening to a carefully rehearsed act, despite the fact that he knew her to be a ruthless and merciless killer, yet his heart had twisted at the tones of despair in her voice, the muffled weeping perfectly done. So he had only just been able to identify it. "This is the residence of Baroness Altman. Gaston, speaking, sir. General Stride. Good evening, General. I was expecting your call. I spoke to the Baroness earlier. She asked me to arrange your passage to Les Neuf Poissons. I have done so. Where is it, Gaston?"
"Les Neuf Poissons. It's the Baroness's holiday island in the Ile sous le Vent. It is necessary to take the UTA flight to Papeete Phare on Tahiti, where the Baroness's pilot will meet you. It's another 100 miles to Les Neuf Poissons, and unfortunately the airstrip is too short to accommodate the Learjet. One has to use a smaller aircraft."
"When did the Baroness go to Les Neuf Poissons?"
"She left 7 days ago, General," Gaston answered, and immediately went into the smooth, efficient secretarial voice to give Peter the details of the UTA flight. "The ticket will be held at the UTA check-in counter for you, General, and I have reserved a non-smoking seat at the window."
"You think of everything. Thank you, Gaston."
Peter replaced the receiver and found that his earlier exhaustion had left him. He felt vital and charged with new energy. The elation of a trained soldier facing the prospect of violent action. Or was it merely the prospect of an end to the indecision and the fear of unknown things? Soon, for good or for evil, it would be settled, and he welcomed that. He went through into the bathroom and pitched the whiskey that remained in his glass into the hand basin. The UTA DC-10 made its final approach to Tahiti Phare from the east, slanting down the sky with the jagged peaks of Moorea under the port wing. Peter remembered the spectacularly riven mountains of Tahiti's tiny satellite island as the backdrop of the musical movie South Pacific that had been filmed on location here. The volcanic rock was black and unweathered, so that its crests were as sharp as sharks' fangs. They arrowed down across the narrow channel between the two islands, and the runway seemed to reach out an arm into the sea to welcome the big silver machine. The air was heavy and warm, and redolent with the perfume of frangipani blossoms, and there were luscious brown girls swinging and swaying gracefully in a dance of welcome. The islands reached out with almost overpowering sweetness and friendliness. But as Peter picked his single light bag out of the hold luggage and started for the exit doors, something unusual happened. One of the Polynesian customs officers at the gate exchanged a quick word with his companion and then politely stepped into Peter's path. "Good afternoon, sir." The smile was big and friendly, but it didn't stretch as far as the eyes. "Would you be kind enough to step this way?" The two customs men escorted Peter into the tiny screened office. "Please open your bag, sir." Swiftly but thoroughly, they went through his valise and crocodile skin briefcase. One of them even used a measuring stick to check both cases for a hidden compartment.
"I must congratulate you on your efficiency," said Peter, smiling also, but his voice tight and low.
"A random check, sir," the senior officer answered his smile. "You were just unlucky to be the 10,000th visitor. Now, sir, I hope you won't object to a body search."
"A body search?" Peter snapped, and would have protested further. But instead he shrugged and raised both arms. "Go ahead." He could imagine that Magda Altman was as much the grande dame here as she was in Mother France. She owned an entire island group, and it would need only a nod to have an incoming visitor thoroughly searched for weapons of any sort. He could imagine also that Caliph would be very concerned that the intended victim should be suitably prepared for execution, lest he should inadvertently become the executioner. The one customs officer checked his arms and flanks from armpit to waist, while the other knelt behind him and checked inside the outside of his legs, from crotch to ankle. Peter had left the Cobra in the safe deposit box in the Hilton in Brussels. He had anticipated something like this. It was the way Caliph would work.
"Satisfied?" he asked.
"Thank you for your cooperation, sir. Have a lovely stay on our island." Magda's personal pilot was waiting for Peter in the main concourse, and hurried forward to shake his hand.
"I was worried that you were not on the flight."
"A small delay in customs," Peter explained.
"We should leave immediately if we are to avoid a night landing on Les Neuf Poissons. The strip is a little difficult."
Magda's Gateslier was parked on the hard stand near the service area, and beside it the Norman Briton Tri-Islander looked small and ungainly, a stork-like, ugly aircraft capable of the most amazing performance in short take-off and landing situations. The body of the machine was already loaded with crates and cartons of supplies, everything from toilet rolls to Veuve Clicquot champagne, all tied down under a wide-meshed nylon net. Peter took the right-hand seat, and the pilot started up and cleared with control. Then to Peter,
"One hour's flying, we will just make it."
The setting sun was behind them as they came in from the west, and Les Neuf Poissons lay like a precious necklace of emeralds upon the blue velvet cushion of the ocean. There were 9 islands in the characteristic circular pattern of volcanic formation, and they enclosed a lagoon of water so limpid that every wall and twist of the coral outcrops showed through as clearly as if they were in the air. The islands had a Polynesian name when the Baron purchased them back in 1945. The pilot explained in the clearly articulated, rather pedantic French of the Midi. They were given by one of the old kings as a gift to a missionary he favoured, and the Baron purchased them from his widow. The Baron could not pronounce the Polynesian name, so he changed it, the pilot chuckled. The Baron was a man who faced the world on his own terms. 7 of the islands were merely strips of sand and fringes of palms, but the 2 to the east were larger, with hills of volcanic basalt glittering like the skin of a great reptile in the rays of the lowering sun. As they turned into their downwind leg, Peter had a view through the window at his elbow of a central building with its roof of palm thatch elegantly curved like the prow of a ship in the tradition of the islands, and around it, half hidden in luscious green gardens, were other smaller bungalows. Then they were over the lagoon, and there were a clutter of small vessels around the long jetty, which reached out into the protected waters. Hobie cats with bare masts, a big powered schooner, which was probably used to ship the heavy stores, such as dieseline, down from Papeete, power boats for skiing and diving and fishing.